joining us for the Noon Book Hour. We hope you'll join us again tomorrow for our next installment from the Recording Library of West Texas.
Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the coronavirus update, followed by USA Today at 2.
To bring us up to time for our next regularly scheduled program, we now bring you the following informative feature.
Vaccines. Odessa Regional Medical Center is expecting COVID-19 vaccines soon. Please check on vaccine availability. Call 432-582-8549. As usual, the Ratliff Stadium vaccines will be ongoing. Walgreens has limited COVID-19 vaccines available in select areas. For eligibility requirements or more information, visit tinyurl.com/YHR6NEUD. HEB is prepared to receive new allotments of COVID-19 vaccine at any time from the state of Texas. Once they have vaccine, eligible customers can sign up using the scheduler to receive a COVID-19 vaccine. To sign up or for more information, visit vaccine.heb.com. CVS stores are administering the COVID-19 vaccine by appointment only in select stores based on local eligibility guidelines. For updates or information, visit tinyurl.com/Y508QJE4. Walmart and Sam's Club pharmacies are administering the COVID-19 vaccine based on state and federal eligibility guidelines in select areas. For updates, visit tinyurl.com/Y5K95KZN.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 38 with fog. Tonight, clear with a low in the upper 50s. Then, tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the low 70s. Tomorrow night, it will be cloudy with a low in the low 40s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 1 p.m.
Good afternoon. Welcome to your coronavirus update from the Recording Library of West Texas for Tuesday, February 9th, 2021. I'm Michael, and coming up in this program today, we'll read these articles and more. Why bad news for AstraZeneca's vaccine is a roadblock on the way out of the pandemic. South Africa COVID-19 variant does not appear to be more transmissible, British health expert says. Pfizer says it has increased productions to double coronavirus vaccine output. Russia's Sputnik V trampled all biotech protocols and seems to have succeeded. U.S. considers mobile vaccination centers to tackle undersupply of shots, White House advisor says. Ford rolls out clear N95 level masks and do-it-yourself air filtration kits. One in three COVID-19 patients put on a ventilator experience extensive PTSD symptoms, UK research shows. First, we'll take a look at the numbers. The numbers from the Texas Department of Health Services is still not updating Ector or Midland County numbers. I'm going today to look at the Johns Hopkins University data. For Ector County, confirmed cases, 14,488. Deaths, 302. Zero new cases since the previous day. County fatality rate, 2.08. For Midland County, confirmed cases, 15,687, 224 deaths, zero new cases since the previous day. County fatality rate, 1.43. From the Texas Tribune, average new cases decreased by 4,004 cases compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On February 8th, 6,613 new confirmed cases and 1,216 new probable cases were reported. Hospitalizations decreased by 1,673 patients compared with a week ago. As of February 8, 9,401 Texans are hospitalized for the coronavirus. Average new deaths stayed the same compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On February 8, 57 new deaths were reported. Now we'll look at coronavirus briefs. U.S. COVID numbers have continued their slide, with daily new cases falling 23% and new deaths down 12% over the past week. The numbers are still twice as high as over the summer, however. The United States reported 86,646 new cases of COVID-19 and 1,465 additional virus-related deaths on Monday, according to a tally by Johns Hopkins University. That raises the national total to at least 27,094,014 infections and 464,941 fatalities since the pandemic began. At least 59,307,800 vaccine doses have been distributed, and at least 42,417,617 shots administered, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. A 12-day investigation by a World Health Organization team has shed little new light on the origins of the coronavirus that sparked a devastating pandemic. In a news conference Tuesday in Wuhan, central China, the heads of the Chinese and WHO delegations said they were unable to conclude whether the virus had passed directly from animal to human or through an intermediary host, although WHO experts say an intermediary host species is most likely how COVID-19 was introduced to humans. They said the virus was extremely unlikely to have spread as the result of a lab accident. Chinese health officials say Hunan Market might not be the first place of the COVID-19 outbreak. House Democrats proposed sending full $1,400 stimulus payments to Americans who earn up to $75,000 a year, rejecting plans to limit eligibility for the checks. Health experts warned that the spread of variants in the U.S. mean it's very risky for states to ease COVID-19 restrictions now. Experts warn the U.S. could be in the calm before the storm, ahead of another possible surge in COVID-19 cases fueled by variants, and urged local and state leaders not to ditch their safety measures and restrictions. U.S. considers COVID-19 testing requirement for domestic air travel. U.S. ramping up COVID-19 genome sequencing to track variants, CDC director says. Los Angeles County is only offering second doses of COVID-19 vaccine due to shortage. New data suggests Russia's COVID-19 death toll in 2020 is among the highest in the world. New figures released by Russia's Federal Statistics Agency Monday indicate as many as 162,429 deaths in Russia were related to COVID-19 in 2020, a figure much higher than previously reported. Russia officially reported 57,555 deaths from COVID-19 in 2020. Over 45% of deaths in England and Wales were COVID-19 related in the last week of January. The WHO's Director General, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, urged manufacturers to adapt vaccines to new variants. South Africa paused its rollout of the AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine after a study showed it offers less protection against a variant first identified in the country. After suspending the rollout, South Africa is scrambling for a new vaccine plan, which could be a preview for when the rest of the world confronts the new variants. Athletes to be tested for COVID-19 at least every 4 days at Tokyo Olympics. And now let's move to our articles today. Why bad news for AstraZeneca's vaccine is a roadblock on the way out of the pandemic. From CNN's Ivana Katasova. It's the news that many people feared. Early data shows the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine may only provide minimal protection against mild to moderate illness caused by the coronavirus variant first identified in South Africa. A study released on Sunday from a South African university suggested that two doses of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine provided substantially reduced protection against mild to moderate COVID-19 disease from the new virus variant first identified there, known as B1351. South Africa said that it is pausing the rollout of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine following the release of the study. But this doesn't mean governments should throw out their AstraZeneca stockpiles. Experts say it's possible and very likely that the shot is still effective in preventing more severe disease and death. The news could, however, be a major roadblock on the world's way out of the pandemic, which can't end until the virus stops circulating widely. That's because the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine is cheaper and easier to transport and store than some of the other vaccines approved to use to date. And as such, was going to play a key part in combating the pandemic in low and middle income countries. If the vaccine isn't effective enough against the new variant, it could deepen the already huge vaccination gap between the world's richest and poorest countries. Less effective vaccines could force countries where the new variants become dominant to shift their vaccination strategy. Instead of trying to achieve herd immunity, the focus might be on preventing as many deaths as possible, even while the virus continues to circulate. And while the data from South Africa is no doubt a setback to vaccination campaigns, scientists are already working on updates to the existing vaccines to make them more effective against new variants. On Saturday, AstraZeneca said it is working with Oxford University to adapt the vaccine against the B1351 variant and that it would advance it through clinical development to make it ready for autumn delivery should it be needed. Last month, Pfizer said it was laying the groundwork to create a vaccine booster that could respond to coronavirus variants. We see this all the time with the influenza vaccine. Dr. Julian Tang, honorary associate professor and clinical virologist at the University of Leicester, said, "Flu vaccines are adapted each year to target the virus strains that are circulating the most. Sometimes the vaccine pick doesn't match the strain that becomes prevalent. Mismatched vaccine seasons do allow more influenza infections, morbidity, and mortality. But to some extent, that is inevitable, as the virus will always be mutating first. Then we will have to adjust our vaccines to match the new virus," Tang added. The UK Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, said Monday, the flu blueprint might work for the coronavirus in the future. The jab is updated each year according to the mutations and variations that have happened and been spotted in the preceding few months, and that is manufactured over the summer and then delivered into the arms of those who are most vulnerable to flu in the autumn, he said. When it comes to COVID-19, he explained that we need to be thinking about how to protect people in a similar way. The good news is that developing a vaccine that would work against the new variants doesn't mean starting from scratch, so updates could become available soon. South Africa COVID-19 variant does not appear to be more transmissible, British health expert says, from CNN's Amy Cassidy. British analysis does not suggest that the South African coronavirus variant is more transmissible than other variants, England's Deputy Chief Medical Officer Jonathan Van Tam said Monday. Van Tam's analysis was based on early data on modeling the variant, he said. He contrasted the South Africa variant with what he referred to as the Kent variant, referred to internationally as the UK variant, which he said does have a transmissibility advantage. Some context. Van Tam's comments come a day after South Africa paused its rollout of the Oxford AstraZeneca coronavirus vaccine after early data from a study showed that it offered minimal protection against mild and moderate illness caused by the more contagious virus variant first identified there, known as B1351. Pfizer says it has increased production to double coronavirus vaccine output. From CNN Health's Nadia Koenig. Efficiencies and upgrades in the production process have helped vaccine maker Pfizer double its output of coronavirus vaccine in the past month, a spokesperson for the company told CNN Monday. While the company did not give any production figures to support the estimate, Spokeswoman Amy Rose said Pfizer expects production time to be cut nearly in half, from 110 days to an average of 60 days for one batch of COVID-19 vaccine. One batch is equal to between 1 million to 3 million doses, Pfizer says. Producing the genetic material that forms the basis of the vaccine initially took 16 days, but soon will take just 9 to 10 days, Rose said. Pfizer CEO Albert Bourla said last week the company expects to deliver 200 million doses of its vaccine to the United States by the end of May. Russia's Sputnik V trampled all biotech protocols and seems to have succeeded. By the Washington Post's Robin Dixon, Moscow. Russian science and President Vladimir Putin's ambitions of turning the country into a global technology powerhouse is having something of a moment. Russia's Sputnik V coronavirus vaccine now has a globally recognized seal of approval after British medical journal The Lancet published a peer-reviewed paper last week that put the vaccine in the same league as Western doses, with 91.6% efficacy 21 days after the first shot and 91.8% for those over 60 years old. For Russia's biotech industry, the results are a heady validation after facing Western skepticism, fueled largely by Russia's decision to release the vaccine before medical trials were complete, even using researchers as test subjects. U.S. considers mobile vaccination centers to tackle undersupply of shots, White House advisor says, from CNN Health's Jacqueline Howard. Getting COVID-19 vaccination appointments has been a challenge for many Americans because we're in a situation of undersupply of vaccine, according to Andy Slavitt, the senior Biden White House advisor for COVID response. We're in a situation, and we will be for a little while, of undersupply, Slavitt told NPR's Mary Louise Kelly on All Things Considered on Monday. At one point, we thought there was a lot of manufacturing that had gone on over the last year, and that would be the case. It wasn't, and I think our job is to level with folks, he said. But the good news is we are increasing production every week, Slavitt added. We've increased production that we've delivered to states by over 20%. We're opening 100 community vaccination centers, including two that are open already. Slavitt said supply has been increasing in recent weeks, but added, these are all small steps. None of them are silver bullets. I don't think this is going to be the administration that's going to overpromise or promise silver bullets, but these are all small gains. And he added that in their effort to get more people vaccinated against COVID-19, the Biden administration is considering mobile vaccination centers that can travel within a community. They can go to workplaces, they can go to churches, they can go to communities, Slavitt said. Elsewhere, a U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention spokesperson told CNN the CDC will host a COVID-19 vaccination forum with national, state, and local health practitioners on the safest and most effective ways to vaccinate Americans. The event is scheduled for February 22nd through the 24th and will be led by CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky, along with officials from the White House COVID-19 Response Team and the Federal Emergency Management Agency. The initiative was first reported by NBC News. Ford rolls out clear N95-level masks and do-it-yourself air filtration kits. By the Washington Post's Hannah Denham. Ford is rolling out clear masks with N95-level filtration in what could be the largest-scale effort to produce masks specifically designed to improve communication while offering medical-grade protection against the coronavirus. Masks make it more difficult to hear what the wearer is saying and impossible for those who rely on lip reading. The ability to read facial expressions also is crucial, particularly for those in fields such as education, healthcare, and travel, as most communication is nonverbal. When you think about interactions in a work environment, and the people who might be relying on lips to read expressions and understand day-to-day work, that becomes a challenge. It literally takes away another sense from somebody, said Jim Bombick, the Ford vice president overseeing its personal protective equipment manufacturing effort. The auto giant has been producing masks, ventilators, and face shields since March through the launch of its Project Apollo, which organized Ford engineers to work with health officials and devise product solutions to deal with the coronavirus pandemic just days after the first wave of lockdowns. Since then, Ford has given away tens of millions of masks, Bombick said. The new masks, which the company announced last week, will be washable and feature anti-fog technology, Bombick said. They will be available this spring, pending N95 certification. Ford also unveiled a do-it-yourself air filtration kit for indoor spaces to reduce particle spread. One in three COVID-19 patients put on a ventilator experience extensive PTSD symptoms, UK research shows, from CNN's Sharon Braithwaite. New research in the UK shows around one in three, 35%, of COVID-19 patients put on a ventilator experience extensive symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, after treatment. The research conducted in the UK by Imperial College London and the University of Southampton also found that extensive symptoms of PTSD, such as intrusive images of the ICU environment, were also found in 18% of patients hospitalized without requiring a ventilator. The results of the study were published Tuesday in the UK Royal College of Psychiatrics BJ Psych Open Journal. The study was conducted in May 2020 when researchers surveyed symptoms of PTSD in over 13,000 British patients with experience of confirmed or suspected COVID-19. The study also found lower levels of extensive symptoms of PTSD for patients given medical help at home, 16%, and patients who required no help at home but experienced breathing problems, 11%. The most common PTSD symptom experienced by COVID-19 patients was intrusive images, sometimes known as flashbacks. For example, this could be intrusive images of the ICU environment, ICU doctors wearing full PPE, or other patients in the ICU. The authors highlight the importance of following up with COVID-19 survivors after treatment and access to mental health treatment. Dr. Adrian James, president of the Royal College of Psychiatrists, said over 400,000 patients have been hospitalized from COVID-19 in the UK, and sadly, there will be more to come. Many of those fortunate enough to survive their ordeal will experience a significant impact on their mental health. Effective and joined-up follow-up care must be provided after discharge, and mental health services must be adequately expanded to treat increasing numbers of people with PTSD symptoms. And now we're going to move to report regarding the frontline healthcare workers. We'll read this first article, and if we have time, we have a second shorter article. Our first story is from the Texas Tribune. Half of Texas's nurses experience workplace violence. A Texas lawmaker says it's time to protect them. By Shannon Najambadi and Neelam Bora. Published February 9th. State Representative Donna Howard was working as an intensive care unit nurse in the 1970s when a patient pulled an intravenous drip out of his arm and walked toward her. She rushed to help him but didn't see the metal urinal he was clutching behind his back until it was too late. He smacked her in the jaw with it, knocking her across the room. "I was briefly stunned by the hit," said Howard, then working at Breckenridge Hospital in Austin. "But I continued working." For decades, healthcare workers have faced rampant violence in the workplace. Now praised as heroes of the pandemic, those frontline medical workers have been routinely scratched, bitten, or verbally abused by patients. Well over half of Texas's nurses reported being subject to violence, workplace violence in their career, according to a 2016 state study. Nationwide, the rate of violence for healthcare workers increased more than 60% between 2011 and 2018, and the Occupational Safety and Health Administration has found the rate of serious violent incidents in healthcare is more than four times greater than those in other industries. It is presumed to be a part of the job, Howard, Democrat Austin, said of the violence. That's not okay. There are no federal laws that specifically target violence in nurses' workplaces. OSHA does not require healthcare facilities to have violence prevention plans, though states like California and Washington have passed laws to do so. Howard has filed similar legislation in Texas that, if passed this year, would place Texas in a vanguard of states that have backed similar protections for nurses. It would require healthcare providers to create committees to prevent workplace violence and to offer medical treatment and other services after a violent incident. It would also bar facilities from penalizing nurses who report abuse. They are there to take care of us, and I think we have the responsibility to take care of them, Howard said, adding that this year especially, lawmakers have a moral obligation to take care of healthcare workers who have been risking their lives throughout the pandemic. State lawmakers for years heard examples of violence nurses face. Representative Stephanie Click, Republican Fort Worth, who has worked as a nurse, said in a committee hearing that her wrist was broken by an elderly patient and that she had to have surgery to repair it. Cindy Zolnirik, head of the Texas Nurses Association, said a patient tried to punch her in the face on her first day as a graduate nurse. She quickly stepped back to avoid being struck. And in 2013, an emergency room nurse named Nora Broadhurst told a panel of lawmakers she had had a traumatic amputation of her right ring finger after it was bitten off by an intoxicated spring break patient who she was trying to help. I will never have my finger back to wear the ring my grandmother gave me, she said. Is this going to interfere with my wanting to help the next patient? I am right-handed. Everything I do involves this hand. That year, the legislation strengthened the penalties for assaulting emergency room workers, putting the offense on par with harming first responders. Lawmakers later signed off on creating a grant program to find creative ways to lower the number of verbal and physical attacks against nurses. Those efforts have been focused on training, trying to quickly identify patients at high risk of lashing out, or raising public awareness about the rate of violence, Zolnirik said. Nurse advocates say that a protective approach is essential to stop assaults before they happen and leave healthcare workers and patients traumatized by the experience. Many members of the general public, they're like, are you kidding me? People assault nurses? They don't understand that it's a problem, Zolnirik said. In Texas, more than a third of nurses surveyed for a 2016 report who did not report a recent violent incident said it was because it was an accepted, expected part of the job, or because they did not expect anything to change. About a quarter of nurses and nearly a third of those in freestanding emergency centers said their employer was not at all or only slightly effective at managing workplace violence. It's not just nurses. Respiratory therapists, dietary aides, and other healthcare workers all face violence. Nearly half of emergency room physicians have reported being physically assaulted at work. Dr. Teresa Tran, an assistant professor of emergency medicine at the Baylor College of Medicine, said violence is an unfortunate commonality in emergency rooms everywhere and something workers there have to always be vigilant about. An OSHA webpage says people who work in hospitals, nursing homes, and other healthcare facilities face significant risks of violence in part because they may work closely with people who have a history of violence or are under the influence of drugs. A state report said nurses have the highest risk among health professionals because of how often they interact with patients. And unfortunately, at that point in this article, I need to stop because we're running close on time, and I will have to hold off on reading the second frontline healthcare workers article that I had hoped to have for you this afternoon. So we'll end here and wrap up our coronavirus update for the day. Coming up next, we'll have the program Enabled. And then following that, national news from USA Today. Then at 3 o'clock, it's our local news broadcast. And here are some of the articles our volunteers have been reading today. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram, coronavirus. Midland Health says vaccinations in and around Midland top 20,000. COVID. Mass vaccinations in Midland to continue for 3 months. Small Bites. Shipley Donuts, Kung Fu Tea, Fat Bird Wing Bar coming soon. From the Odessa American this Tuesday, here are some of the articles our volunteers are reading. ECISD to discuss Ector College Prep. Challenging Times. Practicing medicine during COVID challenging. And booster vaccines begin February 15th at Urgent Cares. Those stories and more at 3, and then we'll bring you more national news at 6 from the Wall Street Journal. Thank you very much for joining us today. We'll be back tomorrow at 1. Be safe and have a great day.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 41 and mostly cloudy. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-50s. Then, tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the low 70s. Tomorrow night, cloudy with a low in the upper 30s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas.
Thank you for listening to Enabled this week. I know it's the middle of winter, and I know you probably don't really want to go outdoors, but soon the weather will get better, and you'll be eager to get outside and enjoy what nature has to offer. Today you'll find out about outdoor accessibility on trails in New Hampshire, on a beach in Florida, and in our national parks. I'll start with an article from the Sierra Club, and I will give thanks now to my Reach Out Radio colleague, Kathy Van Skyke, for sending me this article. It's from the sierraclub.org website. The headline reads, Accessibility for the Blind, a Burgeoning Movement, Braille Trails, Sensory Gardens, and More. The article was written by Stacy McKenna, was published in November of 2020. Whether he's hiking in his beloved White Mountains or ascending a distant peak, Randy Pierce pays attention with all of his senses. He listens to the wind as it whistles through a ravine or rustles in the stand of American beech trees. He lets the fragrance of a forest, as it becomes dominated by pine, tell him when he's reached an elevation milestone. With one hand on a trekking pole and the other on his guide dog's harness or a friend's backpack, Randy Pierce feels the ground and focuses on the shifts in his partner's movements to anticipate roots or rocks in his path. Even the air on his face provides clues about his environment, he says. Here's a quote, "People who have been blind all their life are better at it than me, but I can walk along and I can feel when I am close to a massive tree because the air pressure changes. Or I can feel when I'm close to a glacial erratic because of the temperature change." At the summit, Randy Pierce visualizes the sweeping views his companions describe, relishing in the fact that he gets to see such vistas through multiple sets of eyes. And on cloudy days, he often can tell those same friends what would be in their sight line if the skies were clear. That's because he prepares for his hikes by tracing raised relief maps with his thumb while listening to descriptions of the landscapes. Although an estimated 32.2 million adults in the United States identify as blind or unable to see or experience difficulty seeing even with corrective lenses, many nature-based experiences remain difficult to access for blind and partially sighted individuals. Some of these barriers are physical. Nature-based experiences often require venturing into geographically isolated places, which of course becomes especially difficult for individuals who depend on public transportation. And once there, people who are blind or partially sighted may grapple with additional challenges, says Christopher Dixon, Youth Program Manager at the Center for Visually Impaired in Daytona Beach, Florida. Seemingly simple endeavors like navigating new terrain or finding a trailhead can be tricky in the absence of accessible information. Here's a quote from Christopher Dixon. If you haven't had proper mobility training at that location, where do you go? How do you get around? What's there? Where are things? Dixon says it's hard to get there. And once you get there, it's hard to get around if you haven't been there before. Some of this is challenging. Across the country, networks of what are called Braille trails include educational placards in Braille, guidelines to delineate the path, and tactile walkways or smartphone-accessible audio tours. Things that are called sensory gardens explicitly take the experience beyond the visual, incorporating plants that make strange sounds, have unique scents, or are appealing to touch, or can be tasted. In recent years, the National Park Service has added audio guides and brochures at dozens of its parks and is slowly working toward improving transit options in some areas. You will hear much more about this topic later. The article continues, still, even with some concrete obstacles out of the way, personal and intrapersonal obstacles continue to keep many blind and partially sighted people from embracing the outdoors. Megan O'Connell Kopp is an adaptive physical education teacher at the Perkins School for the Blind in Watertown, Massachusetts. As she introduces her students to sports and outdoor activities, she finds many of them have internalized others' perceptions of their limitations. That's what she said. After Randy Pierce, the man from New Hampshire, lost his vision at the age of 22, the result of a neurological disease, he quit hiking and climbing for nearly 20 years. It wasn't until his condition worsened, temporarily landing him in a wheelchair, that he started to think about the outdoors again. As he worked with a physical therapist to regain his ability to walk, she sought out creative ways to challenge him and inspire him. One day, she encouraged him to try using a hiking stick in place of his more stable quad cane. Well, in 2009, 4 years after he began the process of getting his feet back under him, Randy Pierce was hiking again, in earnest. By August of 2013, he had summited all 48 of New Hampshire's 4,000-foot peaks in both winter and summer, and he had his sights set on adventures from the Grand Canyon to Kilimanjaro. For youths who, unlike Randy Pierce, may not have fond memories of the wilderness adventures to motivate them, innovative programs are still opening doors. In 2016, Perkins unveiled an accessible park adjacent to the school along the banks of the Charles River. The paved path, marked by a guide wire and dotted with Braille markers at points of interest, such as the sensory garden or canoe-shaped benches, this paved path gives students the chance to explore independently and using multiple senses. In Central Florida, the Young Sound Seekers program, started earlier this year, introduced a group of blind and partially sighted students, most of whom had never been to a national park. The Young Sound Seekers program introduced them to the soundscapes of Canaveral National Seashore. The NPS-funded program is a collaboration between the Atlantic Center for the Arts, Daytona Beach's Center for the Visually Impaired, and Stetson University in that area. It aims to give the youth a real-life opportunity to hone practical skills, such as navigating unfamiliar ground, and introduces them to nature in their own backyard. You'll hear more about this program very shortly, too. This article continues, though, by saying, at its core, the Young Sound Seekers teaches students to interrogate their environments using sound. At the program's second in-person meeting on a Saturday, the group gathered in the shade of a live oak canopy at Seminole Rest, listening to bird calls, listening to squirrels scrambling among the branches, a breeze whispering through the moss, even a jet rumbling overhead. guided by Stetson University Professor of Digital Arts and Music Technology, Nathan Wolek, participants described what they heard and discussed the role that sounds play in the ecosystem. In a modified version of the National Park Service's Time Machine exercise, they imagined what it might have sounded like when the indigenous Timquan people were shucking oysters and tossing the shells into the area's nascent middens 3,000 years ago. And in case you're not familiar with that word, middens, the area's nascent middens, this is an ancient garbage dump. That's a good way of describing it. That's what the Timucuan people were doing, chucking oysters and tossing the shells into the area's middens 3,000 years ago. They were imagining that. Using senses other than vision is fundamental to the way blind and partially sighted people experience the world, Dixon explains. We use our hands, here's a quote, we use our hands and our fingers to look and see and feel, he says, adding, listening is just another tool for understanding what's beyond our fingertips. Thus, expanding nature-based resources in ways that showcase an array of sensory experiences is an essential part of making those spaces more welcoming to individuals who are blind or partially sighted. It's also an important way in our visually oriented culture to expand how typically sighted visitors perceive the outdoors. Now we'll switch to another article. As mentioned before, this information came from the Daytona Beach News Journal. Their website is news-journalonline.com. The article was written by Abigail Mercer and it was published in October of last year. The headline reads, Learning to Listen. Blind, low-sighted students benefit from the Atlantic Center program. We're going to Florida now. Here we go. Hang on. Bird calls, crashing waves. Many find relaxation in the sounds of nature. For children and young adults with visual impairments, those sounds can also be a valuable way to get information about the world around them. As part of a 5-year, $300,000 grant from the National Park Service's program called Natural Sounds and Night Skies, the Atlantic Center for the Arts is partnering with Stetson University and the Center for the Visually Impaired to create what they're calling the Young Sound Seekers Program. The 10-month program includes excursions to Canaveral National Seashore, dedicated to learning about sound ecology and expanding the students' view of the world around them. Dr. Nathan Wolek, professor of digital arts and music technology at Stetson, works on the curriculum for the project. He is focusing on teaching active listening, as well as helping the students expand their vocabulary about the world around them. Here's a quote. There's a difference between hearing and listening. Hearing is a more passive activity, and listening is much more active. You're taking those sounds in. You're assessing them, Wolek said. It was really neat to have a group of people, 11 in all, and be the only people on the beach for about a mile. We really listened to the sound of the waves crashing against the shore, the smattering of birds flying down, the sound of the grass on the dunes fluttering in the wind, just layering that groundwork for future excursions. Those future excursions will happen once a month until May, and each day out at the Canaveral National Shore will work students toward their end goal, creating an audio-focused podcast to listen to on the park's mobile app. Instead of pointing out visuals such as the types of birds or trees, Dr. Wolek said the podcast will be geared toward blind and low-sighted people. Already, Wolek said, he's been impressed with the students' skills. While he often has to explain to his university students the difference between sound and noise, a word that has a connotation of unwanted sound, these young sound seekers did not have that problem. He said, I've been teaching at Stetson for 16 years now, so I've had plenty of experience. It's a common topic in some lectures to talk about the difference between sound and noise. But this group didn't even talk about that, he said. For the first time in my 16 years, I had a group of students that did not conflate the words sound, and noise in our initial conversations. Eve Payor, Director of Community Programs for the Atlantic Center for the Arts, called this project a labor of love. Between teaching the students about environmental conservation and helping them expand their vocabulary of the world around them, it's something Payor thinks can make a real difference for the students. Here's a quote from her. "I find it's important for us to explore the subtleties of life," she said. "One of our goals is to provide these students a safe environment where they can enjoy listening to these sounds, just to enjoy them and have a moment, instead of doing so because they need to." And while students listen to their surroundings for enjoyment, Payor said they can take the opportunity to teach them about the environment and the problem of sound pollution. Trying to communicate, whether it be for mating or looking for food, has become increasingly hard for animals, Payor said. She compared it to trying to shout across an increasingly busy highway. Here's a quote. "It's so important to understand our place in the ecosystem. We can learn stories and map sounds just by listening," she said. "The stressors of different sounds are well documented. People can get illness from too much noise, and that translates to wildlife too. It gets hard for animals to communicate with the noise pollution. It can stress them out." Ronay David, CEO for the Center for the Visually Impaired, this is in the Daytona Beach area, Ronay David said the program, which is focused on students aged 14 to 22, is going to be a large step toward getting them ready for college or careers. Here's a quote from her. "This is helping them to provide skills that they need to become self-sufficient," David said. "The students are really enjoying it. It's so wonderful for them to get outside and learn and be in the parks and experience this." Payor said the pilot project for this 5-year grant will be a benefit to both the students taking part in the program and the community around them. The article ends with a quote from her. "The real important thing for us to give the blind and partially sighted community is to make them feel welcome and to allow them to contribute to the community by telling their stories. It's really about giving them independence." Now you should know, even though we're in the middle of winter, that this article is accompanied by a picture showing the students gathered on a weathered wooden boardwalk. It leads from a grass-covered sand dune to what seems to be an endless stretch of empty white sand beach. The ocean is a vibrant turquoise blue. White foamy waves are gently coming up onto the beach. There's another picture with this article that shows the students gathered under a spacious pavilion with an arched roof. Two students are sitting at each picnic table, facing the instructor. Behind the instructor, there is a view of the ocean. And for those of us in more northern climates, please note that there's no snow in these pictures and the sun is out. This is from Daytona Beach, Florida. And once again, this program was called the Young Sound Seekers, sponsored by the National Park Service in collaboration with the Atlantic Center for the Arts, Daytona Beach's Center for the Visually Impaired, and Stetson University, all in the Daytona area. Earlier in the program, I mentioned that in recent years, the National Park Service has added audio guides and brochures at dozens of its parks and is slowly working toward improving accessibility options in some areas. Well, I've picked out a few areas to take you to and have a look, see what's going on. So here's an example of what the National Park Service is doing. Information comes from their website, nps.gov. We're using Cape Cod as our first example. The headline or the section reads, "Blind, Low Vision Accessibility, Learn and Explore." They have a lead-in paragraph that says, "Much of Cape Cod National Seashore is accessible to those who are blind or have low vision. In addition to the accommodations listed below, vision-impaired and audio-only versions are now available of the main park brochure. Cape Cod National Seashore and many other National Park Service sites now have full audio-described versions of their main park brochure. The brochure is available in text only, audio only, and an interactive text and audio app for both Android and iOS Apple devices. Some of the points that they make here, there are 9 of them. They have large print versions of official park publications. These are available at the Salt Pond area, this is in Cape Cod Park, or at the Province Lands Visitor Centers and at the park headquarters. They also mention there is the Button Bush Trail near the Salt Pond Visitor Center. This trail has guide ropes and Braille signage. Next we have they claim that there is a Braille translation of the park brochure. It's available for use at the 2 visitor centers and at park headquarters. The next point they make, the 4 park movies shown at the 2 visitor centers have been audio described and assistive listening devices are available. The next thing they want you to know, the lobby exhibits at the Salt Pond area and Province Lands area have tactile features, and at the Wampanoag exhibit in the Salt Ponds Museum there are phone sets for audio messages. The next point, crosswalks at the Salt Pond have tactile markings. The next point, exhibits follow visual accessibility guidelines for color, contrast, font, and point size. And the next point they make, Province Lands Visitor Center has a tactile floor plan available, and the actual exhibit's gallery is described for people who have low or no vision. And the final point they made here is that web content is accessible to screen readers, and social media posts include hashtag alt text. Another possible destination if you're doing this national park tour is the Statue of Liberty National Monument in New York Harbor. Information Center is located a short walk from the boat dock. Liberty Island Information Center offers visitors a narrated movie about the statue's history. The volume of the film is adjustable by the ranger. The park brochure audio described text for the Statue of Liberty National Monument is available as a Word document. There is a Braille-ready park brochure available to use, and there are 2 tactile displays within the Information Center. We come to Ranger programs at the Statue of Liberty. All Ranger programs strive to engage multiple senses and learning styles, and often include audio components and/or tactile objects. Ranger-led tours are offered year-round and are outside on the grounds of Liberty Island, which has brick walkways. There is little elevation change. Some walkways slope slightly. Most walkways are a minimum of 10 feet in width. The Statue of Liberty Museum is there too. Located past the Information Center on the left, the Statue of Liberty Museum is accessible by 2 ramps. Located on either side of the building, or 1 flight of stairs, the museum includes a narrated 10-minute movie, 3 interactive galleries, and restrooms, all located on 1 level. Throughout the museum, visitors can use the self-guided audio tour, which is available with headsets and volume control. A descriptive audio tour is also available for visitors who are blind or have low vision. There are several tactile displays within the museum for visitors to touch. And this is at the Statue of Liberty Museum near the Information Center on Liberty Island. There also, they mention audio tours. An audio tour program is available in a variety of languages. It includes historical accounts on the construction and design of the Statue of Liberty. The audio tour program can be used as a guided tour around the perimeter of the monument and as a narrative to artifacts located within the museum. Audio descriptive tours created specifically for people who are blind or visually impaired are available free of charge from the pavilion located near Liberty Island Information Center. And then we go inside the monument. Visitors with pedestal reservations will have access to various levels of the pedestal. Visitors with crown reservations will have access to the various levels of the pedestal and in the crown of the statue. While visiting the Statue of Liberty, emergency warnings and fire alarms are equipped with strobe or flashing lights. For a detailed description of how to navigate within the monument, you really need to go to their physical mobility within the pedestal page for more details. Now, I also found on the National Park Service website information about service animals, and this applies to all of their parks, but in this case, some of the information is specific to the Statue of Liberty Park. The section is called Service Animals, How Service Animal is Defined. Service animals are defined as dogs that are individually trained to do work or perform tasks for people with disabilities. They are working animals, not pets. Examples of such work or tasks include guiding people who are blind, alerting people who are deaf, pulling a wheelchair, alerting and protecting a person who is having a seizure, reminding a person with mental illness to take prescribed medications, calming a person with post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD during an anxiety attack, or performing other duties. The work or task an animal has been trained to provide must be directly related to the person's disability. Dogs whose sole function is to provide comfort or emotional support do not qualify as service animals under the Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA. This definition does not affect or limit the broader definitions of assistance animal under the Fair Housing Act, or the broader definition of service animal under the Air Carrier Access Act. Some state and local laws also define service animals more broadly than the ADA does. The next section is called Where Service Animals Are Allowed. And remember, this is pertaining to the Statue of Liberty, but there are certain things like this for every national park. Where service animals are allowed. Service animals are welcome in all areas of the park except for access to the crown. This is at the Statue of Liberty once again. Assessments have determined that allowing service animals on the crown stairway poses a legitimate threat to the safety of the disabled handler, to other visitors in the crown, and to the service animal itself. Visitors who wish to make arrangements to leave their service animal in a portable kennel during their visit to the crown should contact the Statue of Liberty Park officials at least 2 weeks prior to their visit. Now, the next point I'm sure applies to all national parks. Service animals must be under control. Guests who use service animals must retain control of their animals at all times and should keep them on a leash or harness while visiting, unless the animal is required to do otherwise in order to mitigate a person's disability. The next section, inquiries, exclusions, charges, and other specific rules related to service animals. Allergies and fear of dogs are not valid reasons for denying access or refusing service to people using service animals. When a person who is allergic to dog dander and a person who uses a service animal must spend time in the same room or facility, they both should be accommodated by assigning them, if possible, to different locations within the room or different rooms in the facility. A person with a disability cannot be asked to remove his or her service animal from the premises unless, number one, the animal is out of control and the handler does not take effective action to control it, or the dog is not housebroken. Staff are not required to provide care or food for service animals. Please note they remind you that other national parks, other than the two that we mentioned today, are adding accessible services at all locations. Also, a little warning, don't forget that the pandemic restrictions may be in effect depending on where and when you plan to visit some of our national parks. So to summarize today's program, pretty soon it will be time to get outside and enjoy spending time in nature once again. Plan ahead and look for some braille trails or sensory gardens. Listen for the quiet on an isolated beach, or even visit one of our national parks. To end the program today, I have a quote for you to think about. Of all the paths you can take in life, be sure a few of them are dirt. This was said by John Muir, also known as John of the Mountains. He's also known as Father of our National Parks. He was an influential Scottish-American naturalist, author, environmental philosopher, botanist, zoologist, glaciologist, and early advocate for the preservation of wilderness in the United States of America.